while in London I had studied at the Inner Temple. I suppose I might have stayed on and waited to be called to the bar, but I have no real love for the law. I could not stomach it. I sailed for New Zealand instead. When I landed at Dunedin not 2 weeks ago, I learned that Otago's gold had been all but eclipsed by new findings here on the coast. I hesitated, not knowing where to venture first, and was rewarded for my hesitation in the most unexpected way. I met my father. Balfour made a murmur, but did not interrupt. He was staring into the fire, his mouth pursed judiciously around his cigar, and his hand loose around the base of his glass. The 11 others were equally still. The billiard game must have been abandoned, for Moody could no longer hear the click of the balls behind him. There was a sprung quality to the silence, as if the listeners were waiting for him to reveal something very particular, or fearing that he might. "Our reunion was not a happy one," Moody continued. He was speaking loudly above the drumming of the rain, loudly enough for every man in the room to hear him, but not so loudly as to make it seem as if he was aware of their attention. "He was drunk, and extremely angry that I had discovered him. I learned that he had become extraordinarily rich, and that he was married again, to a woman who doubtless was innocent of his history, or indeed of the fact that he was legally bound to another wife. I was, I am sorry to admit, unsurprised. My relations with my father have never been warm, and this was not the first time I had caught him in questionable circumstances, though never in a situation of this criminal magnitude, I should hasten to say. My real amazement came when I inquired after my brother, and learned that he had been my father's agent from the outset. They had orchestrated the abandonment together, and had journeyed south as partners. I did not wait to encounter Frederick, too. I could not bear it to see them both together, and made to leave. My father became aggressive and attempted to detain me. I escaped and made the immediate plan to journey here. I had money enough to return to London directly if I wished. But my grief was of a kind that—" Moody paused and made a helpless gesture with his fingers. "I don't know," he said at last. "I believed the hard labour of the diggings might do me well for a time. And I do not want to be a lawyer." There was a silence. Moody shook his head and sat forward in his chair. "It is an unhappy story," he said more briskly. "I am ashamed of my blood, Mr. Balfour, but I mean not to dwell upon it. I mean to make new." "Unhappy indeed," Balfour cried, plucking his cigar from his mouth at last and waving it about. "I am sorry for you, Mr. Moody, and commend you both. But yours is the way of the goldfields, is it not? Reinvention! Dare I say, revolution! That a man might make new, might make himself anew, truly, now." "These are words of encouragement," Moody said. "Your father, his name is also Moody, I presume?" "It is," Moody said. "His Christian name is Adrian. Perhaps you've heard of him." "I have not," Balfour said, and then, perceiving that the other was disappointed, he added, "Which means very little, of course. I'm in the shipping line of business, as I told you. These days I don't rub shoulders with the men on the field. I was in Dunedin for 3 years, near about. But if your pa made his luck on the diggings, he'd have been inland, up in the higher country. He might have been anywhere, to a Topeka, Clyde, anywhere at all. But listen, as to the here and now, Mr. Moody, you're not afraid that he will follow you?" "No," Moody said, simply. "I took pains to create the impression that I departed immediately for England, the day I left him. Upon the docks, I found a man seeking passage to Liverpool. I explained my circumstances to him, and after a short negotiation, we swapped papers with one another. He gave my name to the ticketmaster, and I his. Should my father inquire at the custom house, the officers there will be able to show him proof that I have left these islands already and am returning home."
"But perhaps your father and your brother will come to the coast of their own accord, for the diggings?"
That I cannot predict, Moody agreed. But from what I understood of their current situation, they had made gold enough in Otago.
Gold enough?
Balfour seemed about to laugh again. Moody shrugged. Well, he said coldly, I shall prepare myself for the possibility of their arrival, of course, but I do not expect it.
No, of course,
Balfour said, patting Moody's sleeve with his big hand.
Let us now talk of more hopeful things. Tell me, what do you intend to do with your pile once you've amassed a decent sum? Back to Scotland, is it, to spend your fortune there?
So I hope, Moody said. I've heard that a man might make a competence in 4 months or less, which would take me away from here before the worst months of winter. Is that a probable expectation in your mind?
Quite probable, Balfour said, smiling at the coals. Quite probable indeed.
Yes, one might expect it.
No mates in town, then? Folk to meet you up on the quay? Join up? Lads from home?
None, sir, Moody told him for the third time that evening. I travelled here alone, and as I have said to you already, I intend to make my own fortune without the help of other men.
Oh, yes, said Balfour. Making your own. Well, going after it in the modern way. But a digger's mate is like his shadow.
That's another thing to know.
His shadow, or his wife.
At this remark, there was a ripple of amusement around the room. Not open laughter, merely a quiet expulsion of breath issued from several quarters at once. Moody glanced around him. He had sensed a slackening in the air, a collective relief at the conclusion of his narrative. The men had been afraid of something, he thought, and his story had given them reason to put their fear aside. He wondered for the first time whether their trepidation was connected in some way to the horror he had witnessed aboard the Godspeed. The thought was strangely unpleasant. He did not want to believe that his private memory might be explicable to another man, and still less, that another man might share it. Suffering, he thought later, could rob a man of his empathy, could turn him selfish, could make him depreciate all other sufferers. This realization, when it came, surprised him. Balfour was grinning.
"Aye, his shadow or his wife," he repeated,
nodding appreciatively at Moody, as though the jest had been Moody's rather than his own. He stroked his beard several times with the cup of his hand and laughed a little. For he was indeed relieved. Lost inheritance, falseness in marriage, a high-born woman put to work. These betrayals belonged to a different world entirely, Balfour thought, a world of drawing-rooms and calling-cards and gowns. It was charming to him that such changes in fortune might be counted as tragedies, that the young man might confess them with the stern, controlled embarrassment of a man who had been taught to believe from the moment of his birth that his estate would never change. To speak of that here, at the vanguard of the civilized world. Hokitika was growing faster than San Francisco, the papers said, and out of nothing. Out of the ancient, rotting life of the jungle. Out of the tidal marshes and the shifting gullies and the fog. Out of sly waters rich in ore. Here the men were not self-made, they were self-making, as they squatted in the dirt to wash it clean. Balfour touched his lapel. Moody's story was pathetic, and had aroused in him an indulgent, fatherly feeling, for Balfour liked very much to be reminded that he himself was modern, entrepreneurial, unencumbered by connection, while other men still found it in the trappings of an outworn age. This, of course, was a verdict that said less about the prisoner than about the judge. Balfour's will was too strong to admit philosophy, unless it was of the soundest empirical sort. His liberality could make no sense of despair, which was to him as a fathomless shaft, possessed of depth but not of breadth, stifled in its isolation, navigable only by touch, and starved of any kind of curiosity. He had no real fascination with the soul, and saw it only as a pretext for the greater, livelier mysteries of humour and adventure, Of the soul's dark nights he had no opinion. He often said that the only inner void to which he paid any kind of notice was appetite, and although he laughed when he said it and seemed very well pleased, it was true that his sympathy rarely extended to situations where sympathy was expected to extend. He was indulgent towards the open spaces of other men's futures, but he was impatient with the shuttered quarters of their pasts.
"In any case," he went on, "mark this as your second piece of advice, Mr. Moody. Find yourself a friend. Plenty of parties about that'd be glad for an extra pair of hands. That's the way, you know. Find a mate, then form a party. Never known a man to make it solo. Are you kitted with a costume and a swag?"
"I'm afraid I am at the mercy of the weather on that count," Moody said. "My trunk is still aboard ship. The weather was too inclement to risk crossing the bar tonight, and I was told to expect my belongings at the custom house tomorrow afternoon. I myself was conveyed by lighter. A small crew rowed out very bravely to fetch the passengers in."
"Oh, yes," Balfour said more soberly. "We've seen 3 wrecks in the past month alone coming over the bar. It's a frightful business. There's a penny to be made in it, mind. When the ships are coming in, people don't pay too much attention, but when they're going out, there's gold aboard. I am told that the landing here at Hokitika is notoriously treacherous."
"Notoriously? Oh, yes. And there's nothing to be done about it if a vessel's on the long side of 100 feet. She might blow off a full head of steam, and it's not enough to force her over. Capital fireworks show, with the flares shooting up all around. But then, it's not just the steamers, not just the big ones. It's any man's game on the Hokitika bar, Walter. That sand will ground a schooner on the wrong tide."
"I well believe it," Moody said. "Our vessel was a bark, none too large, agile, hardy enough to weather the most dreadful of storms. And yet the captain wouldn't risk her. He elected to drop anchor in the roadstead and wait for the morning."
"A Waterloo, that her name? She's a regular in and out from Chalmers."
"A private charter, as a matter of fact," Moody said. "Name of Godspeed." He might have pulled a pistol from his pocket, such was the shock that name produced. Moody looked around, his expression was still mild, and saw that the attention of the room was now openly fixed upon him. Several of the men put down their papers. Those who had been dozing opened their eyes, and one of the billiard players advanced a step towards him, into the light of the lamp. Balfour, too, had flinched at the mention of the bark's name, but his grey eyes held Moody's gaze coolly.
"Indeed," he said, seeming in an instant to shed all the effusion and bluster that had characterised his manner up until that point. "I confess to you the name of that craft is not unknown to me, Mr. Moody. Not unknown. But I should like to confirm the captain's name also, if you have no objection."
Moody was searching his face for a very particular quality, one that if he had been pressed, he would have been embarrassed to name aloud. He was trying to see if Balfour seemed haunted. He was sure that if the other man's mind leapt to imagine or to remember the kind of preternatural horror that Moody himself had encountered aboard the Godspeed, then its effect would be only too visible. But Balfour merely looked wary, as when a man hears of the return of one of his creditors and begins in his mind to tally his excuses and methods of escape. He did not look tormented or afraid. Moody was certain that anyone who had witnessed what he had would bear the mark of it. And yet Balfour was changed. There was a new shrewdness to the other man's aspect, a new sharpness to his gaze. Moody felt energized by the alteration. He realized, with a surge of excitement, that he had underestimated him.
"I believe the captain's name was Carver," he said slowly. "Francis Carver, if I remember rightly. A man of considerable strength, with a brooding look, and a white scar upon his cheek. Does that description match your man?"
"It does."
Balfour was scanning Moody's face in turn. "I'm very curious to know how you and Mr. Carver came to be acquainted," he said after a moment. "If you would indulge the intrusion, of course."
"Forgive me, we are not acquainted," Moody said. "That is, I'm sure he would not recognize me if he saw me again."
He was resolved, in accordance with his strategy, to field Balfour's questions politely and without reservation. It would give him license later to demand some answers of his own. Moody had no small genius for the art of diplomacy. As a child, he had known instinctively that it was always better to tell a partial truth with a willing aspect than to tell a perfect truth in a defensive way. The appearance of cooperation was worth a great deal, if only because it forced a reciprocity. Fair met with fair. He did not look about him again, but instead kept his eyes wide and his face open, and directed his speech wholly to Balfour, as if the 11 staring men on his periphery did not trouble him in the least.
"In that case," Balfour was saying, "I shall hazard to guess that you purchased your ticket from the ship's mate."
"Paid him into his own pocket, sir."
"You had a private arrangement with the man?"
"The scheme had been devised by the crew with the master's consent," Moody replied. "An easy enough way to turn an extra shilling, I suppose. There were no berths of any kind. One was allotted a place below decks and instructed to stay sharp and keep out of the way. The situation was not at all ideal, of course, but my circumstances compelled my immediate departure from Dunedin, as you know, and Godspeed was the only scheduled departure on the day I wished to leave. I did not know the mate prior to our transaction, nor any of the other passengers, nor any of the crew."
"How many passengers came in under this arrangement?"
Moody met Balfour's gaze levelly.
8, he said, and put his mouth on his cigar.
Balfour was quick to pounce upon this.
"That's you and 7 others, 8 in sum?"
Moody declined to answer the question directly.
"The passenger list will be published in Monday's paper. Of course, you may examine it yourself," he said, with a slightly incredulous expression, as though to imply that Balfour's need for clarification was not only unnecessary but unbecoming. He added, "My real name, of course, will not appear there. I travelled under the name Philip de Lacy, this being the name of the man whose papers I purchased in Dunedin. Walter Moody, as the authorities have it, is currently somewhere in the South Pacific, bearing eastward, I expect, towards the Horn."
Balfour's expression was still cool.
"Please allow me to inquire one thing further," he said. "I should like to know, merely, whether you have cause to think well or ill of him. Mr. Carver, I mean."
"I'm not sure that I can answer you fairly," Moody said. "I have on my authority only suspicion and report. I believe that the man was under some duress to leave Dunedin, for he was anxious to weigh anchor despite predictions of a coming storm, but I am entirely ignorant of the business that compelled his haste. I did not formally meet him, and saw him only from a distance during the voyage, and then only rarely, for he kept to his cabin much of the time. So, you see, my opinion is not worth very much. And yet..."
"And yet," Balfour prompted, when Moody did not go on. He waited.
"To be frank with you, sir," Moody said, turning squarely to face the other man, "I discovered certain particulars concerning the ship's cargo while aboard that made me doubt her errand was an honest one. If I am certain of one thing, it is this. I wish never to make an enemy of Mr. Carver, if that event is in my power to avoid."
The dark-haired man on Moody's left had stiffened.
"Found something in cargo, you said," he interposed, leaning forward. "Aha," Moody thought, and then, "now is the time to press my advantage."
He turned to address the new speaker.
"Please forgive me if I neglect to elaborate," he said. "I mean no disrespect to you, sir, but we are strangers to one another. Or rather, you are a stranger to me, for my conversation with Mr. Balfour tonight has reached more ears than his alone. In this I am disadvantaged, not unto myself, as I have represented myself truthfully, but unto you,
for you have made my acquaintance without introduction, and heard my piece without invitation or reply. I have nothing to conceal concerning this or any journey I have made, but I confess," he turned back to Balfour, "it rankles to be questioned so relentlessly by an interrogator who divulges nothing of his own design." This was rather more aggressively worded than was Moody's habit in speech, but he had spoken calmly and with dignity, and he knew that he was in the right. He did not blink. He stared at Balfour and waited, his mild eyes wide, for the other man's response. Balfour's gaze flickered sideways to the dark-haired man who had made the interruption, and then back to meet Moody's own. He exhaled. He rose from his chair, tossed the stump of his cigar into the fire, and held out his hand. "Your glass needs refilling, Mr. Moody," he said quietly. "Please be so kind as to allow me." He went to the sideboard in silence, followed by the dark-haired man, who, when he had unfurled himself to his full height, almost grazed the low ceiling of the room. He leant close to Balfour and began to mutter something urgently in his ear. Balfour nodded and muttered something back. It must have been an instruction, for the tall man then moved to the billiard table, beckoned the blond-haired man to approach him, and conveyed a whispered message to him. The blond-haired man began nodding, vigorously and at once. Watching them, Moody felt his habitual quickness return. The brandy had roused him. He was warmed and dried, and nothing caused his spirits to lift more surely than the promise of a tale. It often happens that when a soul under duress is required to attend to a separate difficulty, one that does not concern him in the least, then this second problem works upon the first as a kind of salve. Moody felt this now. For the first time since he had disembarked from the lighter, he found that he was able to think upon his recent misadventure clearly. In the context of this new secret, his private memory was somehow freed. He could recall the scene that haunted him, the dead man rising, his bloody throat, his cry, and find it fabulous, sensational, still horrific, but somehow much more explicably so. The story had gained a kind of value. He could turn it into profit by exchange. He watched the whispered message pass from man to man. He could not distinguish any proper nouns. The jumble of unfamiliar accents made that impossible. But it was evident that the matter under discussion was one that concerned every man in the room. He forced his mind to evaluate the situation carefully and rationally. Inattention had led him to err in judgment once already that evening. He would not err again. Some kind of heist was in the offing, he guessed, or maybe they were forming an alliance against another man. Mr. Carver, perhaps. They numbered 12, which put Moody in mind of a jury. But the presence of the Chinese men and the Maori native made that impossible. Had he interrupted a secret council of a kind? But what kind of council could possibly comprise such a diverse range of race, income, and estate? Needless to say that Walter Moody's countenance did not betray the subject of his thoughts. He had calibrated his expression precisely between grave bafflement and apology, as if to communicate that he was very sensible of the trouble he was causing, but he had no idea what that trouble might be, and as to how he should proceed, he was willing to take anyone's direction but his own. Outside, the wind changed direction, sending a damp gust down the chimney, so that the embers swelled scarlet, and for a brief moment Moody could smell the salt of the sea. The movement in the hearth seemed to rouse the fat man nearest the fire. He levered himself from his armchair with a grunt of effort and shuffled off to join the others at the sideboard. When he had gone, Moody found himself alone before the fire with the man in the herringbone suit. The latter now leant forward and spoke.
"I should like to introduce myself, if you have no objection," he said, snapping open his silver cigarette case for the first time and selecting a cigarette. He spoke with an accent identifiably French, and a manner that was clipped and courteous. "My name is Aubert Gascoigne. I hope that you will forgive that I know your name already."
"Well, as it happens," Moody said with a little jolt of surprise, "I believe I also know yours."
"Then we are well met,"
said Aubert Gascoigne. He had been fishing for his matches. He paused now with his hand in his breast pocket, like a rakish colonel posing for a sketch.
But I am intrigued. How is it that you know me, Mr. Moody?
I read your address this evening in Friday's edition of the West Coast Times, am I right? If I remember correctly, you penned an opinion on behalf of the magistrate's court. Gascoigne smiled and pulled out his matches.
Now I understand. I am yesterday's news.
He shook out a match, placed the side of his boot against his knee, and struck his light upon the sole. Forgive me, Moody began, fearing that he had offended, but Gascoigne shook his head.
I am not insulted, he said when his cigarette was lit. So, you arrive as a stranger in an unfamiliar town, and what is your first move? You find a day-old paper and read the courthouse bulletin. You learn the names of the lawbreakers on the one hand and the law enforcers on the other. This is quite a strategy.
There was no method in it, Moody said modestly. Gascoigne's name had appeared on the third page of the paper, beneath a short sermon, perhaps the length of a paragraph, on the iniquity of crime. The address was preceded by a list of all the arrests that had been made that month. He could not recall any of those names, and in truth had only remembered Gascoigne's because his former Latin master had been Gascoigne. The familiarity had drawn his eye.
"Perhaps not," Gascoigne returned. "But it has brought you to the very heart of our disquiet, nonetheless. A subject that has been on every man's lips for a fortnight."
Moody frowned.
"Petty criminals? One in particular."
"Shall I guess?" Moody asked lightly when the other did not go on. Gascoigne shrugged.
"It doesn't matter. I am referring to the whore."
Moody raised his eyebrows. He tried to recall the catalogue of arrests to his mind. Yes, perhaps one of the listed names had been a woman's. He wondered what every man in Hokitika had to say about a whore's arrest. It took him a moment to find the words to form an appropriate answer, and to his surprise, Gascoigne laughed.
"I am teasing you," he said. "You must not let me tease you. Her crime was not listed, of course. But if you read with a little imagination, you will see it. Anna Wetherell is the name she gives."
"I'm not sure I know how to read with imagination." Gascoigne laughed again, expelling a sharp breath of smoke.
"But you are a barrister, are you not?"
"By training only," Moody said stiffly. "I have not yet been called to the bar."
"Well, here. There is always an overtone in the magistrate's address," Gascoigne explained. "Gentlemen of Westland, there is your first clue. Crimes of shame and degradation, there is your second."
"I see," Moody said, though he did not. His gaze flickered over Gascoigne's shoulder. The fat man had moved to the pair of Chinese men and was scribbling something on the flyleaf of his pocketbook for them to read. Perhaps the woman was wrongly indicted. Perhaps that is what captured everyone's attention.
"Oh, she wasn't jailed for whoring," Gascoigne said. "The sergeants don't care a straw about that. As long as a man is discreet enough, they are quite content to look the other way."
Moody waited. There was an unsettling quality to the way that Gascoigne spoke. It was both guarded and confiding at once. Moody felt that he could not trust him. The clerk was perhaps in his middle 30s. His pale hair had begun to silver above his ears, and he wore a pale moustache, brushed sideways from a central part. His herringbone suit was tailored closely to his body.
"Why?" Gascoigne added after a moment. "The sergeant himself made a proposition of her directly after the committal."
"The committal?" Moody echoed, feeling foolish. He wished that the other man would speak a little less cryptically and at greater length. He had a cultivated air. He made Thomas Balfour seem as blunt as a doorstop, but it was a cultivation somehow mourned. He spoke as a disappointed man for whom perfection existed only as something remembered, and then regretted because it was lost.
She was tried for trying to take her own life, Gascoigne said. There's a symmetry in that, do you not think? Tried for trying?
Moody thought it inappropriate to agree, and in any case he did not care to pursue that line of thinking. He said, to change the subject,
And the master of my vessel, Mr. Carver, he is connected to this woman somehow, I presume.
Oh, yes, Carver's connected, Gascoigne said.
He looked at the cigarette in his hand, seemed suddenly disgusted with it, and threw it into the fire.
He killed his own child.
Moody drew back in horror.
I beg your pardon. They can't prove it, of course,
Gascoigne said darkly.
But the man's a brute. You are quite right to want to avoid him.
Moody stared at him, again at a loss for how to reply.
Every man has his currency, Gascoigne added after a moment. Perhaps it's gold. Perhaps it's women. Anna Wetherell, you see, was both.
At this point, the fat man returned, with his glass refreshed. He sat down, looked first to Gascoigne and then to Moody, and seemed to recognise, obscurely, a social obligation to introduce himself. He leant forward and thrust out his hand.
"Name's Dick Mannering."
"It's a pleasure," Moody said, in a rather automatic tone. He felt disoriented. He wished Gascoigne had not been interrupted quite at that moment, so he could have pressed him further on the subject of the whore. It was indelicate to attempt to revive the subject now. In any case, Gascoigne had retreated back into his armchair, and his face had closed. He began turning his cigarette case over again in his hands.
"Prince of Wales Opera House, that's me,"
Mannering added as he sat back.
"Capital," said Moody.
"Only show in town."
Mannering wrapped the arm of his chair with his knuckles, casting about for a way to proceed. Moody glanced at Gascoigne, but the clerk was staring sourly into his lap. It was clear that the fat man's reappearance had severely displeased him. It was also clear that he saw no reason to conceal his displeasure from its object, whose face, Moody saw with embarrassment, had turned a very dark shade of red.
"I could not help but admire your watch chin earlier," Moody said at last, addressing Mannering. "Is it Hokitika gold?"
"Nice piece, isn't it?"
Mannering said, without looking down at his chest or lifting his fingers to touch the admired item. He wrapped the arms of his chair a second time.
"Clutha nuggets, in actual fact. I was at Kawarau. Dunstan, then Clutha."
"I confess I'm not familiar with the names," Moody said. "I assume they're Otago fields."
Mannering assented that they were, and began to expound on the subject of company mining and the value of the dredge.
"You're all diggers here,"
Moody said when he was done, moving his fingertips in a little circle in the air to indicate that he meant the room at large.
"Not one, excepting the Chinaman, of course,"
Mannering said.
"Camp followers is the term, though most of us started off in the gorge. Most gold on a goldfield's found where? At the hotels, at the shanties. Mates spend the stuff as soon as they find it. Tell you what, you might do better to open a business than to head to the hills. Get yourself a license. Start selling grog."
"That must be wise advice if you've acted upon it yourself," Moody said. Mannering settled back into his chair, seeming very contented with the compliment. Yes, he had quit the fields, and now paid other men to work his claims for a percentage of the yield. He was from Sussex. Hokitika was a fine place, but there were fewer girls than was proper in a town of such a size. He loved all kinds of harmony. He had modelled his opera house upon the Adelphi at the West End. He felt that the old song and supper could not be beat. He could not abide public houses, and small beer made him ill. The floods at Dunstan had been dreadful. Dreadful. The Hokitika rain was hard to bear. He would say again that there was nothing nicer than a four-part harmony, the voices like threads in a piece of silk.
"Splendid," Moody murmured.
Gascoigne had made no movement at all during the soliloquy, save for the compulsive rhythm of his long, pale hands as he turned the silver object over in his lap. Mannering, for his part, had not registered the clerk's presence at all, and in fact had directed his speech at a spot some 3 feet above Moody's head, as if Moody's presence did not really concern him either. At length the whispered drama that was taking place on their periphery began to approach a kind of resolution, and the fat man's patter subsided. The dark-haired man returned, sitting down in his former position on Moody's left. Balfour came after him, carrying 2 sizable measures of brandy. He passed one of the glasses to Moody, waved his hand at the latter's thanks, and sat down.
"Why, oh, an explanation," he said, "for the rudeness with which I was questioning you just now, Mr. Moody. You needn't demur, it's quite true. The truth, sir, deserves a tale, and that's as short as I can make it.
If you would be so kind as to enter our confidence," Gascoigne added, from Balfour's other side, in a rather nasty show of false politeness.
The dark-haired man sat forward in his chair suddenly, and added, "Does any man present wish to voice his reservations?" Moody looked around him, blinking, but nobody spoke. Balfour nodded. He waited a moment more, as if to append his own courtesy to that of the other, and then resumed.
"Let me tell you at once," he said to Moody, "that a man has been murdered. That blackguard of yours, Carver, I mean, I shan't call him Captain, he is the murderer, though I'll be damned if I could tell you how or why. I just know it, as sure as I see that glass in your hand. Now, if you do me the honour of hearing a piece of that villain's history, then you might, well, you might be willing to help us, placed as you are."
"Excuse me, sir," Moody said. At the mention of murder, his heart had begun to beat very fast. Perhaps this had something to do with the phantom aboard the Godspeed after all.
"How am I placed?"
"With your trunk still aboard the bark, is what he means," the dark-haired man said, "and your appointment at the Custom House tomorrow afternoon."
Balfour looked faintly annoyed. He waved his hand.
Let us talk of that in a moment," he said. "I entreat you first to hear the story out."
"Certainly I will listen," Moody returned, with the slightest emphasis on the last word, as though to caution the other man against expecting or demanding anything more.
He thought he saw a smirk pass over Gascoigne's pale face, but in the next moment the man's features had soured again.
Of course, Balfour said, taking the point.
He put down his brandy glass, laced his knuckles together, and cracked them smartly.
"Well then, I shall endeavour to acquaint you, Mr. Moody, with the cause of our assembly."
Jupiter in Sagittarius, in which the merits of asylum are discussed, a family name comes into question, Alistair Lauderback is discomfited, and the shipping agent tells a lie. Balfour's narrative, made somewhat circuitous by interruption, and generally encumbered by the lyrical style of that man's speech, became severely muddled in the telling, and several hours passed before Moody finally understood with clarity the order of events that had precipitated the secret council in the hotel smoking room. The interruptions were too tiresome, and Balfour's approach too digressive to deserve a full and faithful record in the men's own words. We shall here excise their imperfections, and impose a regimental order upon the impatient chronicle of the shipping agent's roving mind. We shall apply our own mortar to the cracks and chinks of earthly recollection, and resurrect as new the edifice that, in solitary memory, exists only as a ruin. We begin, as Balfour himself began, with an encounter that had taken place in Hokitika that very morning. Prior to the dawn of the West Coast rush, when Hokitika was no more than a brown mouth open to the ocean, and the gold on her beaches shone quiet and unseen, Thomas Balfour lived in the province of Otago, and conducted his business from a small shingle-roofed building on the Dunedin harbour front, under a calico banner that bore the legend, "Balfour and Harnett, Shipping Agents." Mr. Harnett had since abandoned the joint venture, of which he had owned only a 1/3 share. He was now enjoying a colonial retirement in Auckland, far from the Otago frost and the fog that pooled white in the valleys in the chilly hours before the dawn. The firm's advantageous location, they were squared with the central wharf and enjoyed a view towards the distant heads of the harbour, brought distinguished custom, and among their many clients was the erstwhile superintendent of Canterbury, a spade-handed giant of a man whose reputation was one of conviction, expansion, and zeal. Alistair Lauderback, this was the statesman's name, had enjoyed a sense of constant acceleration over the course of his career. He was born in London, and had trained as a lawyer before making the voyage to New Zealand in the year of 1851, setting sail with two goals. Firstly, to make his fortune, and secondly, to double it. His ambition was well suited to a political life, and especially to the political life of a young country. Lauderback rose, and rose quickly. In legal circles he was much admired as a man who could set his mind to a task and not rest until he had seen the project through. On the strength of this fine character, he was rewarded with a place on the Canterbury Provincial Council, and invited to run for the superintendency, to which post he was elected by a landslide majority vote. 5 years after his first landing in New Zealand, the network of his connection reached as far as the Stafford Ministry and the Premier himself. By the time he first knocked upon Thomas Balfour's door, wearing a fresh kowhai flower in his buttonhole and a standing collar whose flared points, Balfour noticed, had been starched by a woman's hand, he could no longer be called a pioneer. He smacked of permanence, of the kind of influence that lasts. In his countenance and bearing, Lauderback was less handsome than imposing. His beard, large and blunt like Balfour's own, protruded almost horizontally from his jaw, giving his face a regal aspect. Beneath his brow, his dark eyes glittered. He was very tall, and his body tapered, which made him seem even taller still. He spoke loudly, declaring his ambitions and opinions with a frankness that might be called hubristic, if one was sceptical, or dauntless if one was not. His hearing was slightly defective, and for this reason he tended to bow his head and stoop slightly when he was listening, creating the impression, so useful in politics, that his attentions were always gravely and providentially bestowed. In their first meeting, Lauderback impressed Balfour with the energy and confidence with which he spoke. His enthusiasms, as he announced to Balfour, did not pertain wholly to the political sphere. He was also a shipowner, having cherished since boyhood a passionate love for the sea. He possessed 4 ships in total, 2 clipper ships, a schooner, and a bark. 2 of the crafts required masters. Hitherto he had leased them on charter, but the personal risk of such a venture was high, and he desired to lease the ships instead to an established shipping firm that could afford a reasonable rate of insurance. He listed the names of the ships in rote order, as a man lists his children: the clippers Virtue and Corona Australis, the schooner Lady of the Ballroom, and the bark Godspeed. As it happened, Balfour and Harnett were sorely in need of a clipper ship at that time of the very dimensions and capabilities that Lauderback described. Balfour had no use for the other ship on offer, the bark Godspeed, as that craft was too small for his purposes. But the Virtue, pending inspection and trial, would make the monthly passage between Port Chalmers and Port Phillip very comfortably. Yes, he told Lauderback, he would find a master for the Virtue. He would purchase insurance at a fair premium, and lease the ship on a yearly term. Lauderback was Balfour's contemporary in age, and yet from that first meeting the latter deferred to him almost as a son to a father, showing a touch of vanity, perhaps, for the aspects of Lauderback's person Balfour most admired were the same aspects he cultivated in his own. Something of a friendship formed between the two, a friendship that was rather too admiring on Balfour's part ever to develop into intimacy, and for the next 2 years the Virtue ran unimpeded between Dunedin and Melbourne. The insurance clause, for all it had been painstakingly crafted, was never consulted again. In January 1865, Robert Harnett declared his intention to retire, sold his shares to his partner, and moved north to milder climes. Balfour, with a typical absence of sentiment, relinquished the harbour-front lot immediately. Otago's boom was past its prime, he knew. The valleys were rutted. The rivers would soon be dry. He sailed to the coast, purchased a bare patch of land near the mouth of the Hokitika River, strung up his tent, and began to build a warehouse. Balfour and Harnett became Balfour Shipping. Balfour bought an embroidered vest and a derby hat, and around him the town of Hokitika began to rise. When the bark Godspeed pulled into the Hokitika roadstead some months later, Balfour recalled the name and identified the ship as belonging to Alistair Lauderback. As a gesture of politeness, he introduced himself to the ship's master, Francis Carver, and thereafter enjoyed a cordial relationship with the man, formed on the nominal bond of their mutual connection, though privately Balfour thought Mr. Carver rather thuggish and had pegged him for a crook. He held this opinion without bitterness. Balfour was not awed by force of will, unless it was of the sort that Lauderback displayed, charismatic, even charmed, and he could not love a villain. The rumours that dogged Mr. Carver at his heels did not intimidate him, and nor did they strike a chord of boyish admiration in his heart. Carver simply did not interest him, and he wasted no energy in his dismissal. In late 1865, Balfour read in the paper that Alistair Lauderback was set to run for the Westland seat in Parliament, and some weeks after that, Balfour received a letter from the man himself requesting the shipping agent's collaboration once again. In his campaign to win the Westland province, Lauderback wrote, he wished to appear as a Westland man. He entreated Balfour to secure lodgings for him in central Hokitika, to furnish the rooms appropriately, and to facilitate the shipment of a trunk of personal effects, law books and papers and so forth, that would be of crucial importance to him over the course of his campaign. Each item of business was described in the expansive, flourishing script that Balfour associated in his mind with a man who could afford to waste his ink on curlicues. The thought made him smile. He liked to forgive Lauderback his many extravagances. Lauderback himself would not arrive by ship. Instead, he would make his passage overland, crossing the mountains on horseback to arrive triumphal at the heel of the Arahura Valley. He would make his entrance not as a pampered statesman travelling in comfort in a first-class berth, but as a man of the people, saddle-sore, muddied, and stained with the sweat of his own brow. Balfour made these arrangements as he was instructed. He secured for Lauderback a suite of rooms overlooking the Hokitika beachfront, and registered his name at all the clubs that advertised craps and American bowls. He put in an order at the general store for pears, washed rind cheese, and candied Jamaica ginger. He solicited a barber. He rented a private box at the Opera House for the months of February and March. He informed the editor of the West Coast Times that Lauderback would be making the journey from Canterbury via the Alpine Pass, and suggested that a sympathetic mention of this brave endeavour would recommend the newspaper most favourably to Lauderback's future administration, should he win the Westland seat, as he was likely to do. Balfour then dispatched a message to Port Chalmers, instructing the master of the Virtue to collect Lauderback's trunk, once it had been sent down from Lyttelton, and convey it to Hokitika on the clipper ship's next circuit to the coast. Once all this was done, he bought a demijohn of stout from the Gridiron Hotel, put up his heels, and quaffed it, reflecting as he did so that he might have liked politics, the speeches, the campaigning. Yes, he might have liked it very well indeed. But, as it happened, Alistair Lauderback's arrival in Hokitika was not accompanied by the burst of fanfare that the politician had envisaged when he first set down his plans in his letter to Balfour. His expedition across the Alps indeed captured the attention of the diggers on the coast, and his name indeed featured very prominently in every gazette and newspaper in town, but not at all for the reasons that he had intended. The story recorded by the duty sergeant and published the next morning in the West Coast Times was this. Some 2 hours' ride from their final destination, Lauderback and his company of aides had happened to pass the dwelling of a hermit. It had been hours since their last refreshment, and night was falling. They stopped, intending to request a flask of water and, if the dwelling's owner would oblige them, a hot meal. They knocked on the door of the hut and received no answer, but by the lamplight and the smoke issuing from the chimney, it was evident that someone was inside. The door was not latched. Lauderback entered. He found the dwelling's owner slumped dead at his kitchen table, so freshly dead, he later told the sergeant, that the kettle was still boiling on the range and had not yet run dry. The hermit appeared to have died of drink. One hand was still curled around the base of a bottle of spirits, near empty, on the table before him, and the room smelled very strongly of liquor. Lauderback admitted that the three men did then refresh themselves with tea and damper on the hermit's stove before journeying on. They did not stop for longer than a half hour, on account of the dead man's presence in the room, though his head was resting on his arms, which was a mercy, and his eyes were closed. On the outskirts of Hokitika, their company was further delayed. As they advanced upon the township, they came upon a woman, utterly insensate and soaking wet, lying in the middle of the thoroughfare. She was alive, but only barely. Lauderback guessed that she had been drugged, but he could not elicit any kind of intelligence from her beyond a moan. He dispatched his aides to find a duty sergeant, lifted her body out of the mud, and, while he waited for his aides to return, reflected that his electoral campaign was off to a rather morbid start. The first three introductions he would make in town would be with the magistrate, the coroner, and the editor of the West Coast Times. In the 2 weeks following this ill-starred arrival, Hokitika did not pay the impending elections much mind. It seemed that the death of a hermit and the fate of a whore, this, as Lauderback soon discovered, was the profession of the woman in the road, were subjects with which an electoral candidacy could not be expected to compete. Lauderback's passage over the mountains was only very briefly mentioned in the West Coast Times, though two columns were devoted to his description of the dead man, Crosby Wells. Lauderback was unperturbed by this. He was anticipating the parliamentary elections with the same relaxed self-possession with which he awaited all acts of providence and all rewards. He determined that he would win. Therefore, he would win. On the morning of Walter Moody's arrival in Hokitika, the morning we take up Balfour's tale, the shipping agent was sitting with his old acquaintance in the dining room of the Palace Hotel in Revel Street, talking about rigs. Lauderback was wearing a woollen suit of the lightest fawn, a hue that took moisture badly. The rain on his shoulders had not yet dried, so that it appeared as if he was wearing epaulettes. His lapels had turned dark and furry. But Lauderback was not the kind of man for whom a sartorial imperfection could lessen the impact of his bearing. In fact, the very opposite was true. The damp suit only made the man look finer. His hands had been scrubbed that morning with real soap. His hair was oiled. His leather gaiters shone like polished brass. In his buttonhole he had placed a native sprig of some sort, a pale, bunched flower whose name Balfour did not know. His recent journey across the southern Alps had left a ruddy bloom of health in his cheeks. In sum, he looked very well indeed. Balfour gazed at his friend across the table, only half listening as the statesman, talking animatedly, made his case in defence of the ship of the line, holding up his two palms as main and mizzen, and making use of the salt cellar as the fore. It was an argument that Balfour would ordinarily find engrossing, but the expression on the shipping agent's face was anxious and detached. He was tapping the base of his glass against the table and shifting in his seat, and every few minutes reaching up to pull hard on his nose. For he knew that with all this talk of ships, their conversation would turn before long to the subject of the Virtue and to the cargo that she had been charged to carry to the coast. The crate containing Alistair Lauderback's trunk had arrived in Hokitika on the morning of the 12th of January, 2 days before Lauderback himself. Balfour saw that the shipment was cleared, and gave instructions for the crate to be transferred from the quay into his warehouse. To the best of his knowledge, these instructions were obeyed. But by an unhappy twist of fate, so much unhappier that Lauderback stood so high in Balfour's esteem, the shipping crate then vanished altogether. Balfour, upon discovering the crate was missing, was horrified. He applied himself to the project of its recovery, walking up and down the quay, inquiring at every door, and registering queries with every stevedore, porter, mariner, and customs officer. But his effort was to no avail. The crate was gone. Lauderback had not yet spent two nights together in the suite of rooms on the upper floor of the Palace Hotel. He had spent the past fortnight making his introductions at camps and settlements up and down the coast, a preliminary tour of duty from which he had only been released that very morning. Thus preoccupied and believing the Virtue to be still in transit from Dunedin, he had not yet asked after his shipment. But Balfour knew that the question was coming, and once it did, he would have to tell the other man the truth. He swallowed a mouthful of wine. On the table between them lay the remains of their elevenses, a term Lauderback used to refer to any meal or dish taken at an irregular hour, whether morning or night. He had eaten his fill, and had pressed Balfour to do likewise, but the shipping agent had repeatedly declined the invitation. He was not hungry, most especially for pickled onions and lamb's fry, two dishes whose smell never failed to curl his tongue. As a compromise to his host, out of whose pocket he was dining, he had drunk an entire pitcher of wine and a mug of beer besides. Dutch courage, he might have called it, but the spirits had done little to conquer his trepidation, and now he was feeling very sick.
"Just one more piece of liver," said Lauderback.
"Excellent stuff," Balfour mumbled.
"Excellent, but I'm quite satisfied. My constitution, quite satisfied, thank you." "It's Canterbury lamb," said Lauderback.
"Canterbury, yes, very fine.
Caviar of the Highlands, Tom." "Quite satisfied, thank you."
Lauderback looked down at the liver a moment.
"I might have driven a flock myself," he said, changing the subject. "Happened over the pass. £5 a head? £10 a head, I'd have made a fortune selling up. You might have told me that every piece of meat in this town is salt or smoked. I'd have brought a month of dinners with me. With a pair of dogs, I might have done it very easily."
"Nothing easy about it," said Balfour.
"Made myself a killing," said Lauderback.
"Saving every sheep that breaks its neck in the rapids," said Balfour, "and everyone that's lost, and everyone that won't be driven, and all the miserable hours you'd spend counting them, rounding them up, chasing them down, oh, I wouldn't fancy it."
"No profit without risk," returned the politician, "and the journey was miserable enough. I might at least have made some money at the end of it. Heaven knows it might have improved my welcome."
"Cows, perhaps," said Balfour. "A herd of cows behaves itself."
"Still going begging," said Lauderback, pushing the plate of liver towards Balfour.
"Couldn't do it," said Balfour.
"Couldn't possibly."
"You take the rest of it then, Jock, old man," said Lauderback, turning to his aide.
He addressed his two attendants by their Christian names, for the reason that they shared the surname Smith. There was an amusing asymmetry to their Christian names. One was Jock, the other Augustus.
"Stop your mouth with an onion, and we shall not have to hear any more tripe about your blessed brigantines, eh, Tom? Stop his mouth."
And smiling, he bent his head back towards Balfour. Balfour pulled again at his nose. This was very like Lauderback, he thought. He encouraged agreement on the most trivial of points. He angled for consensus when a consensus was not due, and before one knew it, one was on his side and campaigning.
"Yes, an onion," he said.
And then to get the conversation away from ships,
"Mention in the Times yesterday about your girl in the road."
"Hardly my girl," Lauderback said, "and it was hardly a mention for that matter."
"The author had a fair bit of nerve," Balfour went on, "making out as if all the town deserved a reprimand on the girl's account, as if every fellow was at fault."
"Who's to credit his opinion?"
Lauderback waved his hand dismissively.
"A two-bit clerk from the petty courts airing his peeves."
The clerk to whom Lauderback so ungenerously alluded was, of course, Aubert Gascoigne, whose short sermon in the West Coast Times would also capture Walter Moody's attention some 10 hours later. Balfour shook his head.
"Making out as if it was our error, collectively, as if we all should have known better."
"A two-bit clerk," Lauderback said again, "spends his days writing checks in another man's name, full of opinions that no one wants to hear."
All the same nothing. It was a trifling mention and a poor argument. There's no need to dwell on it.
Lauderback rapped his knuckles on the table, as a judge raps his gavel to show that his patience has been spent. Balfour, desperate to prevent a revival of their previous topic of conversation, spoke again before the politician had a chance. He said, "But have you seen her?" Lauderback frowned.
"Who? The girl in the road? The whore? No, not since that evening. Though I did hear that she revived. You think I ought to have paid a call upon her, that's why you asked."
"No, no," said Balfour.
"A man of my station cannot afford—"
"Oh, no, no, you can't afford, of course."
"Which brings us back to the sermon, I suppose," Lauderback said in a newly reflective tone. "That was the clerk's precise point. Until certain measures are in place, almshouses and so forth, convents, then who's accountable in a situation like that? Who's responsible for a girl like her, someone who has no one, in a place like this?"
This was intended as a rhetorical question, but Balfour, to keep the conversation moving, answered it.
"No one's accountable," he said.
"No one?"
Lauderback looked surprised.
"Where's the Christian spirit in you?"
"Anna tried to take her life. To end her life, you know. No one's accountable for that except herself."
"You call her Anna,"
Lauderback said reprovingly.
"You are on first-name terms with the girl. I'd say you have a share of responsibility in caring for her."
"First-name terms didn't light her pipe."
"You would shut your door to her because she is inebriate?"
"I'm not shutting any doors. If I'd found her in the thoroughfare, I'd have done just as you did. Exactly as you did. Saved her life. Turned her in."
Lauderback waved this correction aside.
"But then what?" he said. "A night in the jailhouse. And then what? Who's there to protect her when she lights her pipe all over again?"
"No one can protect a soul against themselves. Against their own hand, you know."
Balfour was vexed. He did not enjoy discussions of this kind. Really, he thought, it was only marginally better than the relative merits of Ship-Rigged and Square. But then Lauderback had been a poor conversationalist this fortnight past, despotic in tone, by turns evasive and demanding. Balfour had chalked it up to nerves.
"Spiritual comfort, that's what he means. Spiritual protection,"
put in Jock Smith, meaning to be helpful, but Lauderback silenced him with the flat of his hand.
"Forget suicide. That's a separate argument and a morbid one," he said. "Who's there to give her a chance, Thomas? That's my question. Who's there to give that sorry girl one clean shot at a different kind of life?"
Balfour shrugged.
"Some folk have dealt a bad hand. But you can't rely on another person's conscience to live the life you want to live. You make do with what you're given. You struggle on."
In which remark, the shipping agent showed his uncharitable bias, the obstinacy that hung as a weighted counterpoint beneath the lively indulgence of his outward air. For like most enterprising souls, he held his freedoms very chary and desired that all others would do the same. Lauderback sat back and appraised Balfour down the length of his nose.
"She's a whore," he said. "That's what you're saying, isn't it? She's just a whore."
"Don't mistake me, I've got nothing against whores," Balfour said. "But I don't like almshouses, and I don't like convents. They're dreary places."
"You are provoking me, surely," Lauderback said. "Welfare is the very proof of civilization. It is its finest proof indeed. If we are to civilize this place, if we are to build roads and bridges, if we are to lay a foundation for the future in this country,
then we may as well give our road builders something to warm their beds at night," Balfour finished for him. "It's hard work shoveling stones."
Jock and Augustus laughed at this, but Lauderback did not smile.
"A whore is a moral affliction, Thomas. You must call a thing by its name," he said. "You must insist upon a standard if you stand at a frontier."
This last was a direct quote from his most recent electoral address.
"A whore is a moral affliction. That's the end of it.
A bad drain for good wealth.
And your remedy, Balfour returned, is a good drain for good wealth. But it's a drain all the same, and money's money. Leave off the almshouses and let's not go turning any of our girls into nuns. That would be a damned shame when they are so outnumbered as it is. Lauderback snorted.
Outnumbered and outfoxed, I see, he said.
Responsibility for whores, said Balfour. He shook his head. They'll have a seat in Parliament next.
Augustus Smith made a rude joke in response to this, and they all laughed. When their laughter had subsided, Lauderback said,
Let's not talk in this vein any longer. We have discussed that day from all corners and all sides. It makes me tired.
He indicated with a circular sweep of his hand that he wished to return to their previous conversation.
With respect to the ship rig, my argument is simply that how one conceives of the advantages depends entirely on where one stands. Jock held his perspective as a former able seaman. I held mine as a ship owner and a gentleman. In my mind, I see the sail plan. In his, he sees tar and oakum and the breeze.
Jock Smith responded to this jibe conventionally, but with good cheer, and the argument was revived. Thomas Balfour's irritation was revived just as quickly. He felt that he had spoken wittily on the subject of asylum. Lauderback had praised his rejoinder, and he wished to persist with that topic of conversation in order that he might seize the opportunity to do so again. He did not have anything witty to say about the ship rig and its advantages, and neither, he thought sulkily, did Jock, nor Augustus, nor Lauderback himself. But it was Lauderback's custom to begin and end conversations at whim, changing the subject simply because he had tired of a certain issue, or because his authority had been trumped by another man's. Thrice already that morning, the politician had protested the introduction of a new theme, returning always to his imperious patter about ships. Every time Balfour began to speak of local news, the politician declared himself sick to death of useless brooding about the hermit and the whore, when in fact, Balfour thought with annoyance, they hadn't discussed either event in any real detail, and certainly not from all corners and all sides. This internal expression of feeling followed a pattern, though an unacknowledged one.